Good afternoon, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. And I'd like to thank the organisers, and particularly Mina, for inviting me. And I'd also like to thank Novartis for inviting me to their symposium. And delighted to see so many people on a beautiful afternoon here to think about. I think what I would regard as a major advance for us in the management of COPD. And that advance being, for me, the concept of maximal bronchodilatation and how that might change how we manage our patients. And that's what I'd like to explore with you. Before I start, as you've heard, I have a very strange life because I actually live in Norwich in England, but also in Singapore. So not very convenient for each other. And Lebanon is about halfway exactly, actually. Here's my conflicts of interest. If anyone can see a pharmaceutical company that's not on the list, would you mind introducing me to them? Now, COPD has been around for a while, and I think black carbon pigment was actually found in an Eskimo body's AD 400. And there's even some evidence of emphysema in Egyptian mummies, so I don't know what they were smoking, but it clearly wasn't tobacco, but obviously something interesting. Now, when I was thinking about framing this talk, I thought there were three themes that I really wanted to explore. One is the issue for patients about being able to do normal activities. A second one is about trying to have treatment that's easy to use and easy to take. And then finally, and I think very importantly, reducing the impact of exacerbations and the frequency of them. So I think those are the three themes that I'd like to explore with you as I think about changes in the way we're looking at the management of COPD. So thinking about activity, I don't know what the average age of retirement in Lebanon is now, but in the UK it's crept up to 67, and in Singapore it seems to be about 70. What is the average age of onset of COPD? Mid to late 50s. We have a disease that's now not a post-retirement disease. It's actually a working person's disease. And it's very striking that even with relatively mild COPD, as was studied in this group of patients, compared to age-sex-matched controls, they do a lot less walking, standing, and they tend to do a lot more sitting and lying around. So actually they end up relatively immobile. Now this is important at a time in life when they're still expecting to be active. Who likes the gold strategy in terms of A, B, C, D? Who understands it? It is a challenge. I think it's a very brave attempt, though, to talk about the domains that matter, to talk about a symptom domain here, and to talk about a risk domain here, and that our therapies should be different depending on whether we're managing symptoms or whether we're managing risk. And I think if we keep it simple like that, I tend to think it works quite well. I think I find the Spanish guidelines, which are much more about phenotypes, rather more helpful. How is COPD managed? Well, this is a paper we did looking at UK data, and I'm embarrassed, I have to say. You know, I think the UK has probably had the best incentives in place to diagnose COPD, at least, and to regularly assess them. So every patient with COPD in the UK gets annual spirometry, gets an annual assessment of symptoms, at least MRC, gets a check on inhaler technique and smoking status. But what we actually see is how are people treated. And you see there's a lot of patients on very little. This is a database of about 25,000 patients we have. Only a small proportion on bronchodilator therapy only. An awful lot of people on ICS-LABA or ICS-LABA plus ALARMA. By the way, do you know what ALARMA is? other than being a drug for COPD. It's a South American pack animal. Mm-hmm. And you know what a larba is? I discovered this when I moved to Singapore. A larba is actually a spider. So we've got many animals involved in the management of COPD. There's your useless piece of information for today. Now, if we look at this management, you know, and if we take the gold group B, so these are low risk but high symptom patients. So these are people who have plenty of symptoms, who I would argue should be on plenty of bronchodilator therapy. What you see is many of them are on nothing or just short acting. And a large proportion of them are on ICS-containing regimes, for which we have virtually no evidence in this group. In fact, we have no evidence. And what happens if we put them on the wrong treatment at the beginning? Where do they go? They go eventually only onto triple therapy. Expensive regimes for patients which may not be appropriate. Now, why do I care? Well, we're doing a lot of work focused in on whether there's a harmful side of ICS when either used at too high a dose for too long or whether used inappropriately. And I think this analysis that was done by Sammy Sweezer, and this looks at the value of adding an inhaled steroid to a long-acting beta agonist. So this is not the value of an ICS LABA, it's the value of adding an ICS on top of a LABA. And what you see is the number needed to treat, if we take the TORCH trial, probably the biggest one here, what we see, to actually prevent one COPD exacerbation, you have to treat 44 patients. To give one patient pneumonia, you have to treat 16 patients. So we might be doing more harm than good on average. So we need to think about who should be getting ICS. Of course there's a role for them, but who is the right patient? And it's not just pneumonia. We know the pneumonia signal seems to be dose dependent. Osteoporosis. And the one that I think is most important that we're seeing a lot of is progression to diabetes or a worsening of type 2 diabetes. And this analysis came from Canada, looking at people on licensed dose of fluticasone, about a 1.5 times greater risk of developing pneumonia or of progressing to insulin from a non-insulin regime. It matters. And of course, if we think about our alternative strategies, we know the value of bronchodilator therapy. The concept of small changes in airway caliber leading to deflation of hyperinflated lungs. And we also know the concept that regimes that are twice a day tend to be better than regimes 4 times a day. And once a day regimes seem to be better than twice a day regimes. And the concept being that maintaining a patent airway reduces exacerbations, reduces mucus retention, makes people more able to do things. So keeping an airway as patent as possible seems to be important. The other concept I think that's incredibly important is at what stage we need to be aggressively managing patients. And I think the data from the UPLIFT trial, 4-year trial of tiotropium, is very powerful in telling us that actually the gold stage 2 patients, whilst less impaired in terms of health status and less exacerbations than the gold 3s and 4s, actually had a bigger response to bronchodilator therapy, with a greater improvement in health status and a greater reduction in exacerbations. Which actually tells us that the most important time, I think, to be treating COPD is not the 3s and 4s. Of course we should treat those. But the gold 2s is where we see our biggest benefits. Now, what about our alternative treatments? And I just want to review some of that evidence in terms of symptoms, first of all, and also lung function. You know, and if we compare LABAs and LAMAs, I think today, our best lager on the market, certainly in many countries, would probably be Indicatorol. Compared against the reference of tiotropium, pretty comparable changes in lung function. And of course, that's led people to think, is the value in combining different modalities of action? Is the value in combining a LABA and a LAMA? This is some of the early work that was done looking at adding formoterol on top of tiotropium and showing improvements in lung function and in symptom scores. So there seemed to be some value in combining different modalities. And then I think in terms of lung function, if we compare now LAMA-LABA, so this is Ultibro, QVA, the generic name. Compare that with LABA-ICS, fluticasone and salmeterol, in a six-month trial. In terms of lung function, there is no question. The LAMA-LABA is way better than the LABA-ICS. And not just in terms of lung function, but also in terms of breathlessness, in terms of the TDI, the dyspnea index. And what's also interesting to me is that at 3 months there's a difference, but at 6 months it's greater. And this fits with some of the stuff that we saw when we just had the first long-acting bronchodilators used in COPD. The difference versus standard of care improves over time. Why is that? Maybe it's less exacerbations, except these were a low-risk population. Maybe it's about that patent airway enabling people to do more and actually get fitter, almost like natural rehab. But it's a consistent theme that we see through all of the research. So the LAMA-LABAs look fantastic in terms of symptoms. So I've raised question marks about ICS. There are some people who say nobody should be given an ICS with COPD. I disagree with that. There clearly is a population. And I guess one obvious population is those that have comorbid asthma. But what is the actual percentage of patients? The danger is that if you look at diagnoses in databases, it may seem quite high because people have been mislabeled. So this was one of our pieces looking in the UK over the period 1990 to 2009. Particularly in the early part of that time, many people were given an incorrect diagnosis of asthma, which was then changed to COPD. What is the right percentage? And we can maybe discuss that later. Treatments that are easy to use, regimes that are simple. How good is persistence and adherence in COPD? It is diabolical everywhere we look in the world. Which is very strange, isn't it? A disease that makes people really breathless, and yet we see very poor persistence. So this is looking at adherence, and you can see the vast majority of people are under-adhering, and some are over-adhering, with just a small percentage in the right sort of range. And they don't stay on treatments. This is some very nice data. Looking at people started on different regimes, LAMAs, LABAs, LABA-ICS. And what patients persist on them? Actually, it's very, very low. It's incredibly low. We seem to be giving people regimes that they do not stick with. Maybe it's because we haven't given them a regime that's the most effective for them. You know, I think we often only have one or two chances to get it right. So maybe we need to get it right from the beginning. Again, what things might make them more likely to get it right? Well, this is some data from Canada, and it shows that 4 times a day drugs, badly persisted with. Twice a day, a bit better. Once a day, better still. And we've seen that consistently in UK databases too. What about ability to use inhalers? Now I have to say, there's very little research on inhaler devices in COPD. There's a lot more in asthma, and yet it's more problematic. When I'm doing my respiratory clinic, which is all referral patients, virtually nobody is using their inhalers correctly. Virtually nobody. And so this is what this data suggests. With a range of different devices, very few patients who have good technique. And I just wanted to share with you some of our a recent analysis we've been doing. This is in asthma, looking at people on step 3 therapy. And looking at a device that's often regarded as easy to use. And actually, we find quite a high percentage of patients making errors. And do these errors matter? Well, certainly in asthma they do, and I'm sure they matter even more in COPD. People who make errors were twice as likely to be hospitalized, attend the emergency room, get oral steroids, have uncontrolled asthma. Yes, device matters. What do people prefer? Preference may play a part in that. I'm always a bit cynical about preference studies because they always seem to favor the sponsor. But certainly, this study would suggest that the Breezhaler is a well-preferred device. But the other big challenge, I think, with our inhalers is getting the drug out of it. For most dry powder inhalers, it requires a hard, fast suck to break up the drug. That's particularly so for the Discus, also for the Turbohaler, and to some extent with the Handihaler. For MDIs, it requires a completely different technique, a slow inhalation, ideally over 5 seconds. There are other devices. Now, the Breezhaler is a relatively low-resistance device, and it requires the patient to deliver enough volume and enough energy to break up the drugs. It's fixed to lactose. And having looked at the science of this in some detail, as long as a patient can empty the capsule with 2 breaths, they have done it properly. So you've actually got good feedback. So a device that's actually easy for the patient to inhale in, and you can check they've done it correctly. If it takes them more than 2 breaths, then they have not inhaled adequately, and they need to inhale faster. But generally, they've emptied it in 2 breaths, they've got good technique. And the reason for that is it's the inspiratory flow through the low resistance device is actually not affected by their COPD severity. So it's useful across a broad range of patients. So far I've talked about symptomatic disease. What about for the high risk patient who gets exacerbations? Who is going to exacerbate next year? Which patients? Those who exacerbated last year. Certainly, we were looking at what tends to drive doctor behavior. And it's very interesting that the biggest driver of increasing treatment we see is frequent exacerbations. And who is going to exacerbate? Well, this is some work we've been doing with the Respiratory Effectiveness Group, using our database of patients. And this is a small subset, just 3,700, in whom we have CAT as well. What predicts exacerbations? Prior exacerbations, number one. Lung function, lousy predictor. Gold has got it wrong. Being female, I won't comment on that. An asthma record ever. Interesting one here, nasal polyps. And then a really important one here, blood eosinophilia. This was greater than 400. And then finally, being more symptomatic, a high CAT score. We're actually implementing this now in the UK and targeting people who have high risk scores for more specialist management. Another thing thinking about exacerbations is they're not all the same. And this piece of elegant work done by Mona Badafadil beautifully drew out the different triggers for different types of exacerbations. A small percentage, about 22%, were associated with sputum eosinophilia. 29% virus, 55% bacterial. Now tell me, if we're trying to prevent these, should we use the same type of treatment as we used to prevent these? I would say no. This group is surely best prevented with anti-inflammatory therapy. This group may actually be made worse by anti-inflammatory therapy, particularly inhaled steroids. We may be more likely to give these people pneumonia. So maybe we need to stop and think about what type of exacerbations our patients are getting. If they're always associated with blood eosinophilia, treat them quite differently to if they get bacterial infections. And just looking at the blood eosinophils, they are predictive of exacerbations across a range of populations. And I think this study was very helpful in helping us to think about this, led by Vishwavidya. Study that compared tiotropium and ICS larboceratide. And what I found really intriguing here was that exacerbations requiring antibiotics were best prevented with a bronchodilator. And exacerbations requiring steroids were best prevented with an ICS regime. It shows me that doctors are pretty smart, and also that maybe we've got to think much harder about what's going on with our patients. I think this has been brought home even more by this recently published study, the so-called Wisdom Study, that looked at people who were put on a triple therapy regime and to see whether in the presence of dual bronchodilator, LAMA-LABA, you could take away the ICS. 1 year trial, I think an incredibly powerful study. And what does it show? In terms of exacerbations, absolutely no difference. Whether they be moderate to severe or severe. By moderate to severe, community treated, severe, hospital treated. There was a small difference in lung function, but no difference in exacerbations. So what this seems to suggest is in a broad COPD population, you may not need ICS at all. But I've already suggested that maybe there's a group of people with some degree of overlap with asthma who may need them. And it's quite interesting, this study that was recently published suggested the factors that predict who can actually get away with stopping ICS. And the ones who can't get away with it are those with the very frequent exacerbations during the winter and those with sputum eosinophils. Back to the same story. Some of you may have seen this recent paper in Lancet Respiratory Medicine, looking at blood eosinophils as a predictor of who gets add-on value of an inhaled steroid on top of a LABA. This is looking at fluticasone furoate and vilanterol. And what it showed was those with high eosinophils, that they got the benefit. Those with normal eosinophils had no benefit from adding the ICS. And in fact, they had an increased risk of pneumonia. What cutoff is important? Every company is going to disagree on this, but it sits somewhere at around 300 or 400, my take on the literature. And above that point, there seems to be value. If we take a cut point of 400, in our database, that's 12% of people with COPD, 1-2%. What about LAMA-LABA to reduce exacerbations? This is a study that was powered to compare Ultibro versus glycopyrronium, Sebri, as the primary study endpoint. And what was shown is that actually there was a 12% additional reduction of exacerbations by adding the LABA to the LAMA. That is in terms of moderate to severe exacerbations. Community-treated or hospital-treated. If one broadens your definition to include mild exacerbations, which are patient diary collected, now this is really interesting because this is, if you like, flare-ups at home that the patient does not consult medical help for. So they might have a bad week where they're not able to do things. And there you see an even stronger signal, which I think reflects either about symptoms or about minor flare-ups, depending on how you might interpret that. And I think that's very, very important. What about exacerbations versus labor ICS? Now, I think this is an incredibly important space, and we're just starting to see emerging evidence here. And the first one came out of an analysis done. This is a secondary endpoint, not a primary endpoint. Looking at people who were given LABA-LABA or ICS-LABA who were not selected to be low risk. So they were allowed to have one exacerbation in the last year. So this is a broader population of COPD patients. And in terms of lung function, as has been seen before, LABA-LAMA was better than LABA-ICS. No surprises. And what's also interesting, though, is the effect again gets bigger over time. By week 12, much bigger than at day one. So very nice, clear result. But the big thing, I think, that came out of this study was the rate of moderate and severe exacerbations and the fact that they diverge very quickly. And actually, the LABA-LAMA having a lower rate of exacerbations. And this is a broad population, including some that have raised eosinophils. I can't tell you the results of the subgroup who have normal eosinophils versus those that don't, but if you come to the ERS, you will see the data, and it is very exciting. For the definitive answer, we will have to wait for this trial, which will read out later this year. Comparing Ultibro, QVA, and ICS-LABA over a year in high-risk patients. This is, I think, the ultimate study that I think will completely rewrite, I suspect, the way we manage COPD. And that we're going to be starting to say, I think, depending on what the results show, that certain phenotypes do really well with a LABA-LAMA. But for the vast majority of patients, the LABA-LAMA will work well for the majority. For a subset, there's value in the LABA-ICS. And if I was a betting man, I would say that's those with the raised eosinophils. So I hope I've stimulated you to think about a new way, the way we will be managing COPD in the future. That bronchodilatation is the key for the majority of our patients. I've argued that we really should be starting with more aggressive treatment earlier so that we give patients the maximum symptom relief at the beginning of their disease so that they're more likely to persist with their treatments. And then I've also showed the value of maybe getting our inhaler technique correct and using devices that patients can use properly. And a glimpse, I think, into the future management where we're going to stop regarding all exacerbations as the same. We're going to stop regarding all COPD patients with exacerbations as being treated the same too. And that we're actually going to refine and choose our treatment based on the real phenotype of our patients. Thank you very much for listening.